Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And good morning, Bruce. How are you doing today?
I'm good.
I see you just put a link for a frequently asked question in the chat, so I'm going to copy that and post it in the room. Here we go. And I'm going to go to this place. So, sorry about last week.
Not a problem.
It was crazy. I got up there to that, of all the places, the Omni Interlaken Hotel in Broomfield. And not only did I not have internet, I actually couldn't even get a Xfinity, Wi-Fi tower up there, which I can, do that anywhere. Uh-huh. Couldn't get Wi-Fi at all. So, I said, I guess the Holy Spirit really just wants me to just concentrate on this course I'm at and not be messing around here. So it was all worked out perfectly. I had a lovely lady who was a roommate. She was 88 years old.
Yeah.
Wow. Came over to Grand Junction. So it was very interesting, and I had a great time at, it was the Oneness, University that, ran a program, and it's called The Phenomena and the Gift, and this is the third one I've been to, very, very powerful teachings of meditation, basically is what it is. It's, they teach you different meditation techniques that, bring about different states of mind, and you can actually shift your state of mind through using these meditative techniques, and so it's very, very, very powerful stuff.
Nice.
And so that's what I was doing last weekend, was getting actually initiated to do this golden orb meditation and to teach this golden orb meditation. So that is really going to be my focus there for quite a while, is the teaching of this meditation and the performant doing this meditation every day. It really is very helpful, and it just takes you through stages of looking at different things in your life, and it's very, very structured, but it really puts you through where you actually go into a much higher state of mind, and so it's very, very good, very helpful. So that's what I was doing all weekend, and it was intensive. It started on Saturday. We started at 7:30 in the morning, and we went until after 7 at night. And then Sunday we started at 7 a.m. And Sunday I think we were done by 4. But it was very intensive because they were doing broadcasts from India. So So it was in the middle of the night in India. So, it was quite good, quite interesting. So, anyway,
very cool.
All right. So, what's going on with you, and what's been happening with you, Bruce?
Well, mostly more of the same. Just continuing to watch my mind and do all the usual stuff in the world that I would be doing otherwise. And one of the things that crossed my mind that might be timely is since there was the anniversary of the 9/11 event in 2001, I actually watched an interesting documentary last night. I think it was called The Good American, about some people at NSA that had developed this thing called Thin Thread, which, had it been used, could have prevented, possibly the 9/11 situation. So I was thinking, well, what about, that topic seems to bring up a lot of fear around, obviously around, particularly people in this country and, but around the world. And also I was thinking about, the storms that we've been having and, both hurricanes and firestorms in this part of the country. And, I thought, well, how about revisiting just the subject of fear? So I put that in the ACIMOutreach.org, the list of topics, and I just went through a couple and found a couple of FAQs that seemed appropriate. The first one is 242, which is fairly short, and then the other one that I came across was 686. And I was interesting to note that this latter one, number 686, these were written in a period of time that ended about a decade ago, give or take, right? I believe that's about when the last FAQ was written. So as we, if this seems like a good topic for you, if we read this one, you'll probably have some, you know, we'll probably both have some comments on current events.
I'm seeing this.
And how, you know, fear can be symbolized by all kinds of things, but you know, again, it's looking at our own projections. It's looking at what the contents of my mind, not being concerned about what seems to be going on outside, including, you know, public figures, including people that we share the same roof with, or the same, you know, city, county, state, country, continent, whatever, or even solar system or galaxy, I suppose. but to remember that if this course leads us back to the remembrance of the oneness that we never left, the complete inclusion that really is our birthright, then we need to look at all the things that appear to be in our way, and certainly the fear would be, you know, high on the list of the strategies that the ego uses to keep us in our minds only, separate from everything else in the world and in each other. So,
well, and it's interesting. I'm not going to say who this is because we're going to read it here in a minute. But the figures in our dream that are seem significant, and like you're saying, if this was over 10 years ago, this is how significant this particular figure is in our dream, that it's persistent and it doesn't get any less menacing, I'm guessing, until we learn to be without fear. So this is pretty amazing to me when I see this.
I think people might be able to guess, you know, the public figure that is addressed here. But you know, just as a reminder, this FAQ number 686, which was, these were written, you know, in a period ending about 10 years ago, give or take. I don't think they've been added to since then. So, you know, this is current events, but not in the last, year, certainly, that this was written. So shall I go ahead and start reading?
Yeah, I want to go ahead and read the question.
Okay, so again, this is from frequently asked question number 686 in facimoutreach.org, which you can read along if you'd like. Or, you know, if you're listening to a recording, pause the recording and find that on the website. So the short summary of the question is, to me, not everyone seems, quote, uncertain, lonely, and in constant fear. Which is an interesting statement in itself, you know, because it, on the surface, it would appear that, you know, some people have it made, you know, there's some that just seem to have, you know, the life of Riley and everything just goes along wonderfully and, you know, they just have a great life and yada yada and all that kind of stuff. But, and it was certainly, we would wish for everyone to have that kind of life, right? I mean, why would we not? But, if we look at the contents of our minds, we recognize that there's, you know, a mixed bag going on there. And a lot of that mixture, if we're honest with ourselves, and I was talking to C.A. Brooks yesterday about the second and third characteristics of the manual of, you know, of teachers, you know, the honesty and tolerance and how we, you know, we really need to be, you know, also patient with ourselves when we look at this stuff, because there's a lot of chaff in the mind, if we're honest with ourselves. So anyway, I'll read the expanded question now, which is, in the end of the text, Jesus says that all walk the world, quote, uncertain, lonely, and in constant fear. And that's from very, very near the end of the text, in the last chapter, 31, and in section 8, paragraph 7. And the questioner says, I know this may seem silly, but I just don't believe this sometimes. I look at someone like Donald Trump, rich, secure, seemingly happy, and it doesn't seem that he feels the way Jesus describes. I know enough now that this question probably reflects my fear that A Course in Miracles is asking sacrifice of me, but some people seem so happy without the Course. So there's the setup.
Mm-hmm. And now we know what a setup that is. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, Donald Trump is not rich, secure, and happy.
Well, and, but
he
you know, I think
he's pretty insecure and pretty unhappy, actually.
Right, but, and the point of this exercise again, and like I said, I just stumbled across this, and I wasn't looking for that particular person, but it seems timely given our current presidential situation. But what the more important point I think is that if we can look at the contents of our minds and see where we've made judgments, either positive or negative, you know, special love or special hate, with any political figure, any public person, whether it's a movie star or a sports figure or, you know, or a, I don't know, lobbyist or a, or you know, a scientist or a entrepreneur or, you know, it could be anybody that makes the headlines, somebody that, you know, performs a rescue from a hurricane, or someone that withholds vital you know, emergency relief from the same. You know, it could be all kinds of things, right? I mean, anything that crosses our mind is fair game. So anyway, that's just sort of a preface to this. Is it's always and only about the mind that we're talking about here, because that's what A Course in Miracles asks us to look at, is the contents of our mind, which means that anything that appears to be outside of us is in some sense a projection of our minds. If it's fearful, you know, and if it's part of the sin, guilt, fear paradigm that the ego espouses, then that fear is really a projection of the ego mind, and the things that we see outside of us that seem fearful are things that are, you know, a reflection of that choice of teachers. And if there's something that seems peaceful, that is what the Course would call an extension rather than a projection of the awareness of the self, the capital S self that we all share. And that's the inclusive thinking that brings that back to mind and heals the seeming differences and reflects the awareness that everyone and everything, including the ones we, you know, have special love or special hate relationships with, as egos, ultimately have to be reconciled in our minds in order for us to be free of the sabotage of the ego. So
exactly. And as long as we're looking and thinking that one person has something that we don't, or that we have something that another person doesn't, that's the first clue that what we're perceiving is incorrect. Right. And you know, all we're doing is looking to allow our perception to be corrected, and that is only going to happen, you know, when we recognize that nothing I perceive here has any meaning. It really, the only meaning that it actually has is the meaning I give to it.
Exactly.
So, you know, when we come up with these questions, when people, you know, I know people think this kind of stuff a lot, that somehow or the other, some people are getting by without paying the dues. some people are, you know, getting something that I haven't got. In fact, that's the whole ethic of the ego, is that somebody got something I didn't get.
Right.
And that's the whole, you know, talk about Cain and Abel, you know, the very first, you know, big conflict that came about, you know, after, well, the same thing with Adam and Eve and the tree of knowledge. You know, somebody can have this and I don't.
Somehow, as you said, Cain and Abel, I was reflecting on, not even very current, but for anybody who remembers the early Smothers Brothers show on TV, with Tommy Smothers, you know, with the, you know, mom always liked you best, you know, and like I was a pet chicken kind of thing. You know, there's Cain and Abel, you know, but it's always the, you know, the differences that the ego wants to make a big deal about, and whether it's a seemingly positive or negative difference, whether it's you have this good thing and I don't, or you have this bad thing and I don't, you know, or vice versa to either of those. It's all the same dream, and if we can look at the dream without judgment, without condemnation, and just see it as silly, which is what the ancient mysticism and modern physics, and certainly A Course in Miracles, suggests, that, you know, it's all just one being that we are, and so to fragment it out and to make there seem to be all these separate things, which is certainly what our senses tell us, we have to not ignore the sensory data, but just give it a different interpretation. And to, you know, kind of chew gum and walk to multitask to do the things in the world that, that, you know, make sense according to our beliefs and societal norms and all that kind of stuff that, you know, what feels comfortable to us whilst, you know, gradually eroding the barriers in the mind that we've placed to each other. And fear is at the heart of that, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. In fact, fear is, you know, when Jesus says that this, what happened here, this is a journey into fear, that's exactly what this is. It is, this life is a journey into fear. And, you know, if you could just look at that and look at, you know, what is it that I fear? So many people are in denial of the fear. Mm-hmm. So many people are saying, you know, I don't feel the guilt. I don't feel, you know, this is not how I'm experiencing my life. And yet when you look at what they're doing, how they're, the things that they do to protect themselves, you know, right away you can tell whether a person really gets this or not, by how hard they try to protect themselves. And that's either emotionally, mentally, physically. You know, if all I'm doing is thinking of ways to keep myself from having a bad experience, or fixing myself because I had a bad experience, or trying to keep other people I love from having a bad experience, you know, it's all about trying to prevent or trying to get away from the experience that we're having in this world. Mm-hmm. And the only reason that we don't want these experiences is because of fear, because of, you know, fear that comes about because of our belief in our own guilt or our brother's guilt. It all stems from a very innocent but ignorant belief about what we are and what our brothers are. That really brings about this ability, that this feeling of inequality, this feeling that somebody has something I don't have. Donald Trump has something I don't have. And, you know, I could say it's a good thing. I could say it's a bad thing. But, you know, the fact is, if I perceive inequality, I am never going to perceive fairness. I'm never going to perceive justice. And I'm never going to actually experience love. Love rests on equality. That, you know, everything, you know, you're talking about characteristics of a teacher of God. And, you know, what Jesus says in the development of trust pretty basically is, once you've done this, once you've developed trust, all the rest of these things just come to you because you there's no reason not to be honest. You know, there's no reason, you know, what are the other characteristics? There's no reason not to have these characteristics, generosity or whatever, because there's nothing to lose. Mm-hmm. There's nothing to be afraid of. Right. Understanding our equality and developing trust, you get into a place where there is nothing to fear. And that nothing to fear really just shifts everything. Mm-hmm. It, when you're free from fear, you can hear the voice for God, and you do hear the voice for God, and you're not afraid. So you are in perfect trust. And anyway, it's pretty amazing. It's a dynamic, and it's very practical.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that trust develops over time, typically, as the fear subsides over time, and as we, you know, sort of, you know, it's not really necessarily mathematical or linear, but I think, you know, overall, if you were to kind of plot out the amount of time that on a given day that you spend in the thought system of fear and guilt and sin, of course, which is the belief of an error that can't be corrected that the ego espouses, and then plot that, you know, compared to the time that we spent in the peace that our inner kindness teacher suggests has been there all along, covered over by this other stuff, the belief in opposites, the belief in duality, which is the only cause of fear. We could see that, you know, one ramps up over time and one ramps down, and I think that's the natural, true, you know, natural progression of the mind when it begins to look at the insanity of the ego and look at it without condemnation and see that it really can diminish over time, and we can invest more and more of our identity in the reality that we all share. And there's a logic to that peace and that trust too. It's not just, you know, a blind faith or, oh, well, someday this is going to, you know, take. There's an awareness that there's a being that we are now, not just in some future state, but there's an awareness that what we really are right now is that peace and is that innocence and is that joyous truth that we all share. Not the seemingly separate selves that respond to, you know, the name on our driver's license and and, you know, look like the, maybe slightly, but like the picture on the same card in the mirror. But, you know, it's that awareness that somehow transcends all that, that if we go, you know, really deep within ourselves and ask ourselves, well, what is the true logic of this, is that there really could only be one awareness, and tag, we're all it, which is a wonderful, you know, discovery when we realize that we all have to be that same being, and of necessity, but it's not a difficult necessity. It's a joyous. I think somewhere in the course it says, in glad astonishment, you know, we realize that all those fears and all that craziness, you know, was just silly. You know, I paraphrase greatly there. So anyway. So, do you want to read the first paragraph of the answer? Are you still there, Lynn? Hello? Is your microphone
muted?
Yes,
I am. Yeah, I'm still here. I'm muted. My microphone.
Oh, okay, good. I do that too sometimes, and I forget. And it's like, what? Yeah.
So I like the in glad astonishment thing. That's, I love that thought. That, you know, this is the joy that can happen to you. You can actually be in joy rather than fear if you just can do this thing, if you just allow this thing to happen. So, very, very, very helpful all the way through. Here, let me get back to the post. Okay. So the person has asked the question. I'm going to reread the question, just really quickly and then go into the answer. The question is, in the end of the text, Jesus says that all walk the world uncertain, lonely, and in constant fear. And that's from text chapters 31, section 8. I know that this may seem silly, but I just don't believe that sometimes I look at someone like Donald Trump, rich, secure, seemingly happy, and it doesn't seem that he feels the way Jesus describes. I'm pretty sure he doesn't. I know enough now that this question probably reflects my fear that A Course in Miracles is asking sacrifice of me. But some people seem so happy without the Course. So she's thinking that Donald Trump doesn't feel uncertain, alone, in constant fear. And it just says to me how much our perceptions can be off about people because of their TV persona or how they appear to act or be. You just don't know what fears are in a person's heart. And in fact,
I was just going to say, pardon the interruption. I was just going to say that's a perfect microcosm of how little we want to look at our own minds and see the desolation of the ego thought system, because we don't want to question that either. That's just a reflection. That's just a signpost or a mirror that says, oh, there's stuff in my mind that needs to be looked at. Not recoiled in terror, but just looked at gently without condemnation. If I can just look at that insane thought system at work and in process, you know, catch it in the act, not with any incrimination in mind, but just to look at it and see, wow, this is not effective. This is a silly, illogical, crazy, cray cray belief system that, thought system that really has no basis in truth, no basis in the reality that doesn't change.
Oh, yes, and the thing that is so kind of crazy about this is, you know, you think when you see a person who has a lot of money that they're happy or that they're secure, but look at like the Koch brothers and think about how they have, you know, billions and billions of dollars, and, you know, allegedly Donald Trump, you know, has billions of dollars. We're questioning that now, but, you know, allegedly all these people with all this, that's so much more than they ever, ever, ever could live on their entire life. They could live lifetime after lifetime with that money and never, ever be poor. And yet they feel like they don't have enough. Mm-hmm. And there it is. It's that hungry ghost that just makes you think no matter how full you are that you're still starving. And so they're not happy. These people are not happy. They are miserable because they cannot feel secure unless they have everything. And they can't have everything as long as they deny their brother everything.
Right.
That's the only way you can have everything is if you give it to everyone.
Exactly. You know, yeah, and that touches on, you know, what this answer addresses. But I think it's really interesting. The logic of the ego is that if we are separate and therefore only part of all that is, which is what our senses tell us and what our you know, the interpretation of the ego anyway, tells us that we're in this isolated, cut off, you know, body that, well, maybe has a persona but certainly not a mind that's independent of that. From that logic, you know, we're lacking almost everything. You know, if even just on the planetary, let alone, you know, galactic or universal scale, you know, we would need to have and be the entire rest of the physical universe in order to be happy and peaceful. I mean, if you really think about the ultimate insane logic of the ego, that as long as there's, you know, some other atom or molecule in some other distant galaxy that we don't have control over that could mess up things for us, you know, then we couldn't be at peace, right? So that it's basically designed to be an unpeaceful situation. Whereas the supreme wisdom, beauty, and logic and truth of the thought system that truly has no opposite, that which the Holy Spirit represents symbolically, is that if we have and are everything, then we don't need anything. And then they kind of combine that with one of the, you know, the primary statements in the Course, the fundamental statements is that, you know, there is no world. This is the central thought the Course attempts to teach. That would suggest that, okay, if anything involving space and time and bodies and personas is essentially a massive dream, then there must be a reality to our awareness that transcends that, and that awareness does incorporate and include and span everything and everyone, and we all share that. And in that awareness, there is perfect peace, and we get to that by forgiving ourselves for thinking that somehow this hallucination that we made up can have an effect on an impact on this eternal, infinite self we all share.
Exactly. Forgive ourselves, forgive the world, and come to our God with holy, empty hands. Mm-hmm. You know, that's really what it's all about here.
It is, yeah.
And everybody's going to be doing that, you know, and we're going to be glad to have holy, empty hands because, you know, the hands can only hold so much, and they certainly can't hold everything. So much better to have empty hands and own everything than to have full hands and own only that. You know, that's your choice, all or nothing. So either I get it all or I don't have anything. All right. So let's look at the answer here. It is important to remember that in the Course, Jesus is addressing our minds, more specifically, the part of our minds that remembers the truth of who we really are, the right mind. However, since we have dissociated from our minds and identified with the ego and thus with the body, we hear his words as applying to the body. Okay, and we're thinking that's it. Excuse me. Everything goes to my thoughts of the body because that's what I think I am. So there's where the switch has to come. So he says, he is not speaking to our bodies. It is the mind that identifies with the ego body that walks the world and, quote, uncertain, lonely, and in constant fear. Though they may not be apparent, the loneliness, uncertainty, and fear that underlie everyone's existence in the world are the motivation for everything that we seek, money, power, friends, and family. Having believed we are separate from our source, we feel bankrupt, and we are bankrupt if we would be separate from our source. We would have nothing. We feel bankrupt and therefore compelled to fill our physical, psychological, and emotional warehouses to the brim with wealth, health, and happiness. The ego is ingenious in making up its interpretation of, quote, happiness, quote, success, quote, achievement, and even, quote, love, based on the deep sense of loss that inevitably accompanies the choice for separation. The world offers the illusion of happiness, and on its terms, it seems to work for some people. They seem to have it all. It is possible to experience the satisfaction of getting what we want or what we think we want, and it is this the world calls happiness. However, as it turns out, it is never enough. Never enough, never enough. I'm just saying that's the refrain of the ego. Never enough, never enough. Not even with the quote-unquote perfect life here in this world. And so we seek for more. No doubt, Donald Trump, along with many other wealthy and successful people, would admit that there are more fortunes and more power to be had. You can, and this is a quote from Dorothy Parker, you can never be too rich or too thin. And, you know, that's what people think, is that the more I have, the more I am. The more I have, the more I am. But then it turns out, and you'll see this with the Donald and other people who are very rich, like I was talking about the Koch brothers, the more I have, the more I want. That's it. The more I have, the more I want. I'm just going to go for more and more. And in I forget the chapter where Jesus talks about the Antichrist, he says, we know what is the Antichrist. It is more. It's the belief in more. Right. You know, as long as you have this belief that I can get more, I need more, I don't have enough, you will never be satisfied or happy. You're always going to be searching, reaching, looking, lost.
Yeah. And it's not a specific person or persons like the Koch brothers or the Pepsi brothers or whoever. It really is, it's always and only about the mind that thinks the fragmented, as this paragraph suggests, the dissociated, fragmented part of the mind that thinks that it can even identify with a separate self, that has that belief that that's even possible, that, you know, this hologram of a world that we appear to be in, and you know, it behooves us to behave in a way that is, you know, sane on the world's terms, I suppose you could say, so that we, you know, we get along in the world, but at the same time we could kind of multitask, you know, chew gum and walk you know, do the things in the world that are kind and helpful and support ourselves and our families and, you know, the best way we can, while remembering that the real career, the real livelihood, the real purpose for our being here ultimately has to do with undoing our investment in a world and a persona that lives in it, that thinks that there's somehow something we're going to get out of the world. There's that bucket lists are possible, that there's some set of circumstances or conditions or experiences that we can attain or achieve or maybe if we're lucky stumble into that are going to, you know, do it for us. And I love how, you know, Susan Duke and in a lot of her commentary, you ask the question, you know, how's that working out for you? You know, for us, with ourselves, you know, we have to say, well, maybe not so great. You know, maybe if we really look at the outcome of ego strategies and see where that's gotten us, it never really fulfills a happiness that is lasting. We might have an ephemeral, euphoric moment where, oh, wow, I got this task done, or I achieved this goal, or I was able to, you know, do this or that, whatever. I mean, so what? It's kind of like, you know, the kid at Christmas morning after all the presents are unwrapped and half of them are broken and then even the boxes they came in are not any fun to play with anymore at some point, and it's like, okay, now what? You know, it may take, you know, a certain amount of time for that to happen, but eventually, you know, we kind of look around and ask, you know, where's the pony? You know, what's going on here?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I'm just reading this from, it is text chapter 29, section 8, the Antichrist. And it says, paragraph 8, sentence 6 here. Each worshiper of idols harbors hope his special deities will give him more than other men possess. It must be more. It does not really matter more of what. More beauty, more intelligence, more wealth, or even more affliction and more pain. But more of something is an idol for. And when one fails to take when one fails, another takes its place with hope of finding more of something else. Be not deceived by the forms the something takes. An idol is a means for getting more, and it is this that is against God's will. Mm-hmm. And so, Jesus is telling us pretty clearly he's talking about idols, but what an idol is the idea that there's more than everything. Mm-hmm. That, he says that up there earlier too. He says, you know, that the whole thing is the idea that there's more, there's something that is more than everything, and it's not possible. But that's what these guys like Donald Trump do. They're hoping that that special deities will give him more than other men possess. And it doesn't matter more of what. More of beauty, intelligence, wealth, or even affliction and pain. It doesn't matter if it makes us feel good or not. Yeah. The fact that we have more, I have more pain than you do. I have more. That's where I tend to go, because I don't have more money and I don't have more. But I certainly
more
do
martyrdom, though. Like, it's like the Google the four Yorkshiremen if you want to have more of less. You know, if you haven't seen that Monty Python skit, it's hilarious. Yeah, it's a one downsmanship, but kind of thing. Yeah,
Well, and it's true that people really do brag about their afflictions. Because, you know, this shows, oh, I'm so special that, you know, the worst possible things are happening to me, and, you know, and even worse is going to happen, I'm sure. So, you know, poor me, poor me.
Exactly.
It's insanity. So the whole thing is about idol worship, really.
It is. While you were reading from the section on the Antichrist in chapter 29, I looked that up, there's the eighth paragraph there. If you wouldn't mind, I'll read that, because I think it ties into that and kind of captures that really nicely. It says, what purpose has an idol then? What is it for? This is the only question that has many answers, each depending on the one of whom the question has been asked. The world believes in idols. No one comes unless he worships them and still attempts to seek for one that might yet offer him a gift reality does not contain. Bucket list, anyone? Each worshiper of idols harbors hope his special deities will give him more than other men possess. It must be more. It really does not matter more of what. More beauty, more intelligence, more wealth, or even more affliction and more pain. But more of something is an idol for. And when one idol fails to take its place with hope of finding more of something else, be not deceived by forms the something takes. An idol is a means for getting more, and is this that is against God's will. Did you already read that?
I read the second part of the paragraph.
Okay. Yeah, because I thought this is sounding familiar, but I skimmed for the word more. I was like, well, there it is. Okay, yeah. That's why it sounded familiar. It sounded like more of the same.
and the next paragraph says, God has not many sons, but only one. Who can have more and be given less?
Yeah.
In heaven would the Son of God but laugh if idols could intrude upon his peace. It is for him the Holy Spirit speaks and tells you idols have no purpose here. For more than heaven, you can never have. That's it. Mm-hmm. So, what this person is asking this question is saying, you know, it looks like he has more than me. And, but you know what? I have more affliction than he does. I have, you know, look at me. I'm in pain and fear. I'm more oppressed than Donald Trump. I'm.
Or as in the mortal words of Oliver, please, sir, I want some more. But that's really the poverty of the mind that really is what we're looking at here, is the poverty of the mind from the ego's, looking at the ego's through the ego's thought system, is that we never have enough, and so we always need more. Shall I read the second paragraph?
Yeah, please do. This is good. I'm enjoying this a lot.
Me too.
Thinking about the psychology, because they're bringing up Donald Trump, thinking about the psychology of why, because you can ask this question, why does this guy seem so crazy? Why is he so in fear? Why is he so? It is because of this very thing. He will never have enough as long as he believes that he is separate and unequal. He's going to seek for a level of equality that he believes he doesn't have. Because he the only way he can have it is if he has more.
Right. And as you're saying that, I was thinking, maybe for different people, there may be, different symbols going on. But I was thinking, if for me, this administration headed by this person seems like a perfect example of the ego con artist mentality of, well, promise everything but deliver X, promise Y but deliver X. And I think that's, the ego's whole strategy. It's a bait and switch. It basically says, you're going to be happy here. Just follow me, vote for me. But when we vote for our ego, it never delivers. It always, covers its tracks and doubles down and reconfigures and morphs into some other, strategy, an attempt to try to, cover, its tracks and make good on promises that it can never keep. But that's really in all of us. That's not just political figures that happen to be, in the limelight. This is, everyone has an ego that doesn't deliver. And I think that's what's the beauty of this particular FAQ and the course in general, is that it asks us to look at it gently without condemnation and just to see that, there's nothing there, folks. Not the droids you're looking for. Move on.
Exactly.
Okay, so I'll read the second paragraph. Jesus tells us in the Course that in choosing to identify with the body and seeking everything the world has to offer, we have shortchanged ourselves. To identify with the ego is to attack yourself and make yourself poor. Please, sir, may I have some more? That is why everyone who identifies with the ego feels deprived. What he experiences then is depression or anger, because what he did was to exchange self-love for self-hate, making him afraid of himself. He does not realize this. Even if he is fully aware of anxiety, he does not perceive its source as his own ego identification, and he always tries to handle it by making some sort of insane, quote, arrangement, unquote, with the world. And that's from chapter 12 in the text, section 3, paragraph 6. Italics ours, it says. The insane arrangements are all the things we do to avoid feeling the self-hatred. This is what compels us to seek outside of ourselves for comfort and fulfillment. And it's this never-ending, insatiable battle, isn't it? I mean, to try to be safe and comfortable and have enough, even just on the most, you know, rudimentary levels, just having enough money, enough food, shelter, clothing, you know, all healthcare, you know, all those basic things, even for, you know, supposedly, you know, one of the, you know, most prosperous nations on the planet. You know, a lot of people, my hands raised, you know, spend a lot of their day doing stuff just to take care of these, you know, poster children of the ego that we call bodies. You know? Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. Is there anyone listening who doesn't?
And it's never enough.
No.
Never enough. No matter, you know, we just had the greatest vacation. We went to France. We traveled around. But now we're home. But gee, I wish we had gone to the Louvre. I wish we would have. No matter what we did, it never was enough.
Right.
No matter how long we spent, and this is our whole lifetime. When we die in this world, we are laying on our deathbed saying, "I want more. I just want more." And so until we come to this place where we are not believing that we are this body, not believing that this is the limit to us, not believing that this smallness that we appear to be is all there is, therefore we must get more. When we come to the place where we recognize that that's not true, and what we are is an infinite being that has ultimate power, basically, and are not the victim of the world, and are not the beggars here. You know, we are the choosers here. You know, until you come to the recognition that you are the chooser, then you're going to think you're the beggar, and you're going to think that there's got to be more. This is essential. You know, if you're studying this course and you're still living in a world where you believe that lack and fear is a major driver, then you're not really living the way that Jesus is telling you can live. You're not really living the way that we could if we were not caught up in the smallness of the ego body. Anyway, continue on.
Yeah, okay. Let's pick up where I left off here. It says, I'll start with the insane arrangements are all things we do to avoid feeling self-hatred. This is what compels us to seek outside of ourselves for comfort and fulfillment. Every value the world holds has its source in the pervasive feeling of emptiness that is the effect of choosing the ego instead of God. Yet nothing ever fills that void. Jesus tells the Donald Trump and all of us that the world/ego is a bad investment. How's that for a quotable quote?
I love it.
The ego is trying to teach you how to gain the whole world and lose your own soul. The Holy Spirit teaches that you cannot lose your soul, and there is no gain in the world, for of itself it profits nothing. To invest without profit is surely to impoverish yourself, and the overhead is high. Not only is there no profit in the investment, but the cost too is enormous, for this investment costs you the world's reality by denying yours and gives you nothing in return. And that's from chapter 12, section 6 and paragraph 1. A few moments ago when you said something that kind of triggered when we're kind of always searching for, pursuing things, it kind of reminded me of, this is a little bit of trivia that stuck in my brain. Years ago, I was watching, quite a few years ago, as you can guess, Hollywood Squares, and Nipsey Russell was one of the guests in the nine cubicles that make up the tic-tac-toe board. And I'm pretty sure that was the game show anyway. And anyway, there was something about the Bill of Rights and question about that and in this game show, and he turned it around to life, liberty, and the happiness of pursuit. And I thought, well, that's kind of a revelation of how the ego thinks. We think that we're, you know, going to be happy as long as we're pursuing something, you know, that it seems to be outside of ourselves. And that's again, if we just kind of look at it even on the surface, the ego strategy of always seeking for something that it appears to not have or not be, costs us dearly. It's an incredibly expensive identity investment. And, you know, we don't get anything back from it. And we fritter away and squander the time that we could have been spending, reintegrating the innocence, and the joyousness that we really are. And that's kind of cool that we can actually, you know, return to the awareness of what we never left and be restored to, the joy and the gladness. I did find also that the quote that talks about the glad astonishment. Can I read that for a moment?
Oh, yes, please. Yes,
okay.
And yeah. Where is
that? That's in chapter 16 in section 6. Chapter 16 being the forgiveness illusions, section 6, the bridge to the real world. And it's in the second and the third from the last paragraph, 10 and 11. I'll just read those. Paragraph 10 starts out with, "Be glad you have escaped the mockery of salvation the ego offered you, and look not back with longing on the travesty it made of your relationships. Now no one need suffer, for you have come too far to yield to the illusion of the beauty and the holiness of guilt. Only the holy and sane could look on death and suffering, sickness and despair, and see it thus. What guilt has wrought is ugly, fearful, and very dangerous. See no illusion of truth and beauty there. And be you thankful that there is a place where truth and beauty wait for you. Go on to meet them gladly and learn how much awaits you for the simple willingness to give up nothing because it is nothing." And here's where the quote comes from, this next paragraph. "The new perspective you will gain from crossing over will be the understanding of where heaven is. From this side, it seems to be outside and across the bridge. Yet, as you cross to join it, it will join with you and become one with you. And you will think, in glad astonishment, that for all this, you gave up nothing. The joy of heaven, which has no limit, is increased with each life that returns to take its rightful place within it. Wait no longer for the love of God and you. And may the holy instant speed you on the way, as it will surely do if you but let it come to you." So that's kind of the reminder of, you know, where we're headed here, but we get the instantaneous benefits from releasing the fear, guilt, sin paradigm each moment that we recognize its insanity and just say, enough of that. And then the peace that is our true identity comes flooding back in because that's our real identity.
And that's really what happens too. I mean, I've experienced this, you know, in short bursts, not, you know, on and continuous. I'd love it if this was my continuous experience, but I have had this experience where it's just almost like, I can't even, and when he's talking about being, going across the bridge, it's kind of like that feeling, like you're just, you walk from one reality into another. It's like it just kind of enfolds you and you see that just everything is just perfect and right. And, I don't even know how that happens, other than, well, I do know how that happens, because how it's happened to me is when I've gotten to some state in which I was absolutely helpless and had absolutely no idea what to do next, and was in a very dire situation. And in that dire, helpless situation where there is nothing I could do but just let go, I have found myself in a place of just pure
trust.
Peace. Yeah, trust. Yeah, yeah. Just found myself in a place where I just had to let go, and found myself flooded with a feeling of peace and security, and everything just resolved itself. There's no more problem. And you know, coming out of that state, and it is almost like it never happened. The thing that I thought was so terrible is like nothing. And this is a permanent state that can happen without any kind of struggle. Really, it just is it's just letting go. And I think that's what this is just talking about. You get this shift in perspective. And when you're seeing it from another way, it's not the fearful thing we thought it was. Mm-hmm. It's just a beautiful thing. So very cool. Very cool. All right. So where are we at with our question?
I think we're actually, if you want to read the third paragraph,
I will do that. So, a close look at the satisfactions and happiness, quote unquote, happiness the world offer reveals that they are short spent and do not last. Every enjoyment is shadowed by the knowledge that it will end, not to mention that it is nothing but an illusion. And is a quote from the clarification of terms, illusions will not last. Their death is sure, and this alone is certain in their world. It is the ego's world because of this. You know, that's the definition of the ego world, is temporary. You know, mm-hmm. No matter how crazy it seems, it's still temporary. So, and you can be sure of that. You know, you can be sure no matter how much pain you're going to end or how much suffering you're in, it will end in one way or another. There will be something else happening. Despair is when you get into a place where you think it will never end and that you're just going to be feeling this way forever. People go into despair, and that's when people commit suicide or, you know, become, you know, drug addicts or do desperate things because they're in despair. And, you know, if you only understood that every experience in this world is temporary, it will not last. And, you know, no matter how bad it seems, it will be different in just a moment. That's just the way it is. It's always going to be different. No matter how terrible it is, it will be different. We only think that the difference is going to be worse. We just think it's going to get worse. But, you know, the fact that it's temporary just, you know, says you can get through it. And how many things, you know, I'm thinking about having a baby, you know, going through labor and childbirth. You know, you anticipate the next one is going to be worse and worse and worse, but eventually the baby will be born and you're not going to be in labor forever.
Mm-hmm. It's funny you should mention baby, because I was thinking, you know, it's really our infantile attitude about things that are temporary that seems to be, you know, at the immature identity that seems to be at the core of so much suffering, which is to say, you know, when you're a kid and something is wrong and you're crying and wailing, you know, because, you know, your world has been torn asunder. You don't have the perspective of realizing that, you know, a minute later, you know, you're out playing with your friends, you know, and the hurt's gone, kind of thing. Because, you know, we think that this little, you know, speck of existence is all there is. But we forget that in the grander scheme of things, anything that's ephemeral that can come and go, you know, is not going to make us happy. But neither can it make us sad. And that really, you know, that looking at the attachments and the aversions and the comings and goings of illusion, you know, gives us an opportunity to see that, you know, all those things change. And we could see peace instead of this parade of things that appear to please or displease us.
Exactly. And the whole idea of sadness, sometimes we want to be sad. I mean, in fact, sadness brings about a lot of emotional satisfaction. Mm-hmm. And makes us feel very special, feeling very limited. You know, when you're sad, you feel alone. You know, and the ego cherishes that. This is Don't think of, and don't lie to yourself if you say that I don't cherish that. I don't cherish that, that feeling of being the only one and, you know, being, you know, melancholy or we cherish all of these things and we seek them, because they do seem to satisfy us to a certain point. Just like eating a chocolate bar or a, you know, whatever, you get the satisfaction, but again, it's temporary. And so I'm going to go ahead and continue reading because this is they're going to talk about this. So let's see. A close look at the satisfactions and quote unhappiness the world offers reveals that they are short spent and do not last. Every enjoyment is shadowed by the knowledge that it will end, not to mention that it is nothing but illusion. And from the Course, I already read this, but I'm reading it again. Illusions will not last. Their death is sure, and this alone is certain in their world. It is the ego's world because of this. We cannot effectively extinguish the gnawing sense that everything we seek and achieve has an end, including this quote-unquote life in the body, and thus we become imprisoned by the relentless pursuit of pleasure, comfort, and meaning in the world. This often extends to the search for meaningful religious experience and fulfillment. In any attempt to calm our fear that we are, in fact, wrong about who we are and wrong about everything we believe is true and meaningful. Just stopping right there. Just stopping to say. The fear of being wrong is so terrifying to the ego.
Oh, yeah. What if this isn't real? What if I work so hard for all this? It's nothing, you know.
Nothing. What a terrible thing. What a waste of time. What, oh my God.
But you know what isn't a waste of time, and what, you know, even on a very pragmatic, you know, mundane level, is developing the relationships we have with everyone and everything in terms of kindness and being truly helpful. You know, helping each other. You know, whether we're physically present with other people in our, you know, friends, family, community, workplace, whatever, or you know, doing these things remotely, or just in our own mind, you know, it's the intent of wanting to share what is truly helpful, that and you know, that community spirit, if you will, the coming together, the willingness to realize that the separate interests never make us happy, but the shared interests do. And I think that shared interest is really at the heart of and a companion to trusting our inner kindness teacher. And that's why Ken Wapnick points out in the Journey Through the Manual that those two principles are woven through all of that whole third volume, because you know they're so important, I think, to rebuilding. What was never really destroyed, but you know, our awareness of the connection we have with everyone and everything, the true intimacy, the true belonging, the true connection that we have with everyone, it becomes reflected in those behaviors in the world, and that really, I think, is what you know, up in conjunction with forgiving ourselves for thinking that something in the world could have an impact on us in any adverse way, becomes the way that we restore the awareness of the inclusive identity that we have while we're tearing down, if you will, or just recognizing the non-existence of the ego's false identity, that the seemingly separate self that the ego's terrified of losing is mitigated by the awareness that what we really are is in the relationships. And in this, I'm kind of flashing on this documentary that I watched last night called The Good American. They were talking about this thin thread software, and I couldn't help but noticing that the NSA that had this program that was basically just amassing this huge amounts of data, you know, pulled from every conceivable source of information, was basically for the most part, useless, because it was just stored without the context of the relationships And that's why relational databases have changed the world. WordPress, which is, you know, what, over, you know, 27% now of the world's websites are based on WordPress, which is a relational database that's open source, that is, you know, kind of a little bit of an aside here, but, you know, it's all about the relationship that, the interconnectedness of things that really gives the context and the meaning to things. And it's the shared interest that is the relationship that we have with everyone, where if it's being truly helpful to see that connection, that then restores the identity that we never lost. And we can do that in a way that, that has symbolic, counterparts in this world, as, you know, when every person we think of or thinks of us, you know, as the Course suggests, becomes transformed to one of peace and one of forgiveness and one of, you know, kindness, then our identity is transformed at the same time because minds are joined.
Wow, that's a great analogy. I love that, Bruce, because that's exactly right. We are a relational database. Mm-hmm. What we are, even though that is an illusion, but that's what it is. It is that, you know, everything, the interconnectedness, the relationship between, you know, the butterfly effect, you know, I mean, all these different things actually are, that's why when Jesus says, you know, every blessing that you give goes to all the sonship. Every good
Bingo.
That you do goes to everything everywhere. Yeah. You know, that these kind, loving thoughts are changing and shifting the world, not because, you know, they're powerful, but because they're loving. It's, mm-hmm. it's, when you live in a world that was actually made without love, and that is the basic description of what this world is. You know, it's a world that was made without love, that was made actually out of fear. It's a journey into fear, this world, which is, you know, the opposite of love, but love has no opposite. So this is why it is an illusion. Anyway, you know, when you're living in a world that is, just filled with fear, then you can't, all the relationships that you're seeing are negative. You know, this is going to happen then back, you know, we're looking at climate change, we're looking at, politics, we're looking at, the economy, world society, all these different things. Those are all interrelated also, but they're interrelated acts of fear. And so when we begin replacing these acts of fear, these thoughts of fear with thoughts of love, that interconnectedness is what shifts and actually brings people to the bridge. It makes the, that's the other thing that Jesus tells us that's so powerful, is that we, a brother in their right mind, can bring others to the same place. That actually me being in my right mind can shift the Donald Trumps of the world, can shift the Koch brothers of the world or whatever. Or whatever the Putins and the, this is why you can't give up on these people and say, well, they're hopeless and, you know, I'm not going to bless them because, you know, obviously they're going to misuse my blessing, which is what the ego tells you. But honest to God, bring them up in your heart, bring them up in your mind, bring them up and see them as your equal brother.
Exactly.
Being as the Holy Son of God. And they will they will feel that. There's nobody that is so hard-hearted in this world that they cannot hear the call from the Holy Spirit. That's a guaranteed. So, you know, why condemn them and join them in that dark place and contribute to the dark and imagine more darkness? Why? Well, that's a terrible misuse of the mind.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it really just reminds us that, you know, it's all about inclusion. And if we can include everyone in truth, then, you know, the behavior becomes, in a sense, irrelevant, but then it can reflect, and usually does, reflect, you know, that kindness in a way that most people would recognize. But sometimes, you know, we don't see it that way. Sometimes we are asked to do things that don't seem to make any sense, but then when we look at the end result and we say, well, gee, I was there, but I was able to, you know, I had maybe a, you know, something I needed to have fixed on the house, and the service person came out to the house, or I was called to, you know, go to some appointment and that I wasn't really wanting to do or something. But then you understand later that, you know, you made some friendships, or you were able to share a smile, or, you know, say some word of kindness or something, or appreciation that may have made that person's day, you know, and turn things around in ways that, you know, 'cause we don't have any idea where everything that we do goes ultimately. We have such a tiny window on this world, because it's designed to have tiny windows.
Yeah.
You know, little pinholes that we peer through. Yeah.
They're called eyes. Oh.
Exactly.
They're teeny tiny.
So where were we in this reading?
I'm halfway through the paragraph. I'm going to continue. Okay. Let's see. I'll just reread the quote from the course. Illusions will not last. Their death is sure, and this alone is certain in their world. It is the ego's world because of this. So we established that the ego's world is temporary, and so we cannot effectively extinguish the gnawing sense that everything we seek and achieve has an end, including this quote-unquote life in a body. And thus we become imprisoned by the relentless pursuit of pleasure, comfort, and meaning in the world. This often extends to the search for meaningful religious experience and fulfillment in an attempt to calm our fear that we are, in fact, wrong about who we are, and wrong about everything we believe is true and meaningful. As the very first lesson in the workbook tells us, nothing I see means anything. How then can what is meaningless bring us happiness, comfort, or peace? Not only is it meaningless, everything the world offers is actually a defense against recognizing what is meaningful, since it is the place made by the ego. And he quotes from the workbook part 2, where God could enter not, and where his son could be apart from him. And, you know, that's the definition, you know, I said a little bit ago, something else was the definition of this world, but it is. This is the definition of this world, is the place where God can enter not. It's a place that was built out of fear. It's a place that was built out of nothing. And it's, I love, you know, it's almost a pun. And as you read this book, you see these little puns that come up where he, like the first lesson here, nothing I see here means anything. It really is saying that everything I see here is nothing. Nothing I see here has any meaning, because it's nothing. I think that's hilarious. Anyway, he says things like that so often throughout the course that, you know, when you read them, you do just have to laugh, because it's literal. It's so literal, but so obvious. So that's what this world is. If this is a place where God can't even get in, can't see me, I can go and hide and do whatever I want, and he'll not see that I'm doing these things. He'll not judge me or condemn me for doing these things. And he really doesn't have to, because I already did myself. This is where the I did it part comes in. Like, you know, you can't hurt me, God, because I'm already doing it to myself. You can't condemn me, God, because I'm already doing it to myself. Here we come to not be proactive, but kind of, yeah, we come to usurp God's ability to judge us by judging ourselves and judging our brothers. You know, we usurp God's presence and the power in this world by taking it into our own hands. And therefore, we experience the only experience that is possible when you don't let God be in control, is the experience of me being in control. And that's not so good. I haven't found that to be very satisfying.
How's that working out for you? Yep. But when you were talking about the wordplay of nothing I see means anything, I was also thinking how you could take the word mean, and, you know, there's really no meanness in anything. there's no, or animosity, if you will,
exactly.
Given to the Holy Spirit, because how could a dream or a hologram be evil, you know, sinful or wicked? As Ken Wapner points out, he says it's just silly to take something that doesn't exist and ascribe meaning to it, or ascribe meanness to it for that matter. But the real true meaning, of course, is in the connection and in the relationship. I was thinking that, you know, it's really, you know, the Holy Spirit that gives the real meaning, which is, you know, again, it's all about the relationship that we have to everyone and everything through the lens of that oneness that reflects in this world as shared interest and as a sameness, because we, you know, we don't have a direct experience of oneness here, but we can certainly have an experience of sameness where we recognize that, you know, we're all in the same boat. We're, you know, everyone's fighting the same challenging battle here, and we can afford to be gentle with ourselves and each other, and that's that can be very healing, can't it?
Exactly, and you know, that is one of the primary things I've been guided to teach is this sameness. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, Dove did this for a long time, and you know, he's the one who got me into it. I, you know, when I started seeing the perfection of seeing sameness, and even like today, this is what I would tell anyone who's coming to me and saying, you know, I hate this Donald Trump guy, or I hate this, you know, this my boss or my ex-husband or whatever. Stop looking at the things that you think are different between you and start looking at the things that you recognize as the same. It's the same with the nonviolent communication, which Marshall Rosenberg so brilliantly brought out, that we all share the same need no matter what our circumstance in the world.
Uh-huh.
Especially believing that we're bodies, we have very specific needs that are all the same. We need food, we need water, we need oxygen, we have basic things that we need, and then there are also we need relationships, we need to feel accepted, we need to be loved, we need to love. Our needs are very, they're universal. Everyone has, unless they are, you know, have some kind of serious mental deficiency and are incapable of recognizing their own emotion or whatever, everyone has the same needs. And so instead of looking at how, you know, Donald Trump is, you know, being this Mr. Mean, look up the word, meaning of the word mean. I'm not going to do that right now, but there's a lot of meanings to the word mean.
You mean?
You know, he's a mean old man. You know, what does it mean?
The blue meanies.
Mean Mr. Mustard when I think about Donald Trump, so it's pretty funny that we're talking about the word mean. But anyway, it doesn't matter. Why is he a mean old man? Because he's afraid. What is he afraid of? He's afraid of everything, the same thing that you're afraid of, the same thing I'm afraid of. He's not afraid of anything different than what we are all suffering from fear of. So, you know, don't condemn him because he looks to fulfill his needs in a way that seems to be harmful to other people, or whatever you're thinking, you know, whatever I'm thinking about him. Don't condemn him because of that. He's doing what he thinks he needs to do to survive. This is a life or death thing for these people. You know, when people believe that this world has meaning, and people believe that this world has a possibility of effect, and people believe that the body can is what they are, and therefore they can be harmed and even killed. When people believe these things, they live in terror. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, a journey into fear, journey into terror. This is where we are. And so what is my job and your job if we recognize that there is no basis for meanness? There's no basis for, there's no meaning at all.
You know, recognize
that, we can let go. Go ahead.
We can, yeah, pardon the interruption again. I just couldn't resist noticing yet another, meaning of the word mean. And from a statistical point of view, you know, mean is like an average, and the ego is terrified of sameness. So that in the ego's vocabulary, mean as being average would be a, you know, the ultimate curse, because, you know, to be average means to be not different from anyone.
Exactly.
and so again, how the two thought systems are all always diametrically opposed, and only one of them is true, and the truth of what we are is that we're all the same, but it's the same perfection, it's the same innocence, it's the same completeness, but that's something that, you know, ideas that the ego can't wrap its you know, illusory head around. And so the meanness of the ego would be, the curse, if you will, would be to be average and to be the same. Although that's the sameness really is in our relationships, how we find our true identity, and how, as the old identity of difference erodes, the real identity of the sameness, it's not really that it's building, it's being restored to, you know, where it always was in our mind, that, and as we undo the dissociation that the ego represents, you know, we discover that those relationships that we had with everyone and everything really do, you know, are revealed. They are revealed as we let go of the barriers that we've put in our mind to them.
Yes, absolutely. And Dan's has posted something here in the room, the golden mean. And so I went and looked at in ancient Greek philosophy, especially that of Aristotle, the golden mean or golden middle way or Goldilocks theory is the desirable middle between two extremes, one of excess and the other of deficiency. So yeah, the mean, and she's talking about Da Vinci, which the golden ratio.
Yeah, and you probably know that I have an interest in that as well. So synchronistically, if you go to geometrycode.com, you'll find a whole bunch of stuff on the golden ratio and the golden mean. And I have a lot of fun with that. And I, you know, over the years have learned to see that in the light of, well, the ego can use anything to make differences important, but we can also use that golden ratio, the golden mean, as a symbol of interconnectedness. In fact, I've talked about this numerous times on different programs online and elsewhere, how, you know, the golden mean, the golden ratio, the sacred cut, the divine proportion, all those terms having to do with the 1.61803398874 ratio, da da da. can be used either by the ego or the Holy Spirit to represent interconnectedness and sameness ultimately, and beyond that, the oneness that is our true identity, or it can be used to represent differences and, you know, the fragmentation or the spiraling or fragmenting into the labyrinthine cave of darkness of the ego's dissociative mind. And so it's all a matter, again, what is it for? What's the purpose? So thank you for bringing that up, Dancy.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, bringing
that up. And yeah. She says also that it's a spiral, and that's exactly what it is. It isn't just a linear thing. It does spiral. And, you know, I don't see it as spiraling outward. I see it spiraling inward. Because the more you become aware of your own being, what you are, you do draw inward, and that really is where the source of all this is. So yeah. Pretty cool. So yeah. We're beyond the question.
I think we were. Did we finish the third paragraph? I think we did.
We did finish the third paragraph.
Yeah.
Let's see.
So shall I read the last one?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, just again, one more comment is if you are interested in golden ratio, there really is a ton of stuff on the Geometry Code website, and including other interviews that are and conversations, as well as a lot of resources on the resources page on things like that. So, if you have any interest in all of that, just send me a comment through the contact form, and I'd be happy to answer any questions on that. So, because I have a lot of fun with that anyway.
Oh yeah,
to wrap this up, the last paragraph of FAQ 686 is, there is no need to worry that we will have to sacrifice or be deprived of anything we think we need as long as we think we need it. Only the Holy Spirit knows what you need, for he will give you all things that do not block the way to light. And what else could you need? In time, he gives you all the things that you need to have and will renew them as long as you have need of them. He will take nothing from you as long as you have any need of it. And yet he knows that everything you need is temporary and will but last until you step aside from all your needs and realize that all of them have been fulfilled. Let's not be fooled by anything else. So instead of being a full fool, we can be fulfilled.
I love it. And oh my gosh, doesn't this just go with just thinking about the development of trust from the manual of the teachers?
Yep.
And what Jesus says to us, that the final step in the development of trust actually comes about when you ask only, what do I need or what do I want, and give up all judgment. So, stop deciding, I like this and I don't like this, and this is what I want to happen, and this is what I wish and hope would happen. Give up those thoughts that you have, that your design for the universe is better than the Holy Spirit's design for the universe. That comes with that, what we talked about before, being able to admit that we were wrong. But, and that's so easy, right? But
well, that's where the patience comes in, when we recognize that it may not be easy, but it's simple. And we have help every step of the way.
Absolutely. And that's what he says too. If you were not so supported in this, then you would definitely give up. You would never be able to do this if you didn't have the full total support of the Holy Spirit here in Jesus, whatever you want to call it, your inner kindness teacher, whatever you want to call it, is fully supported to achieve this, to be able to remember, to awake, and to recognize that really, truly nothing means anything. And the only meaning it has is the meaning I gave to it.
Yep.
This is so simple. So
really
simple.
It really is.
So, hey, once again, we have filled the 90-minute slot with a wit and wisdom.
Thank you, Lynn. I will post this, and I've got the backlog you sent me of the other conversations, and I think I'm going to have some time to catch up on those pretty soon, as I've been doing with some other ones, and I'll post those on acimblog.com, and look forward to talking to you next week. So thank you.
Oh, absolutely.
As always. Yeah.
Thank you, and I'll tell you what, I just want to let you know again that the website for Awakening Together is so very nice. And
thanks.
It's very much similar to what I'd like to do with mine. So,
okay.
Maybe you can tell me which, I know you told me which template you used before.
Sure.
Shoot
me an email offline and we'll go over that.
Very cool. All right, sweetie. And how's the foundation website going? Is that...
It's coming along really nicely. In fact, a little sneak preview, that what we just got working is a little ticker tape, so that today's workbook lesson will be kind of crawling across the screen on every page. Ooh. And then if you click on that ticker tape, it takes you to the full lesson, which is kind of nice. So 99% of what most people go to the FIP, ACIM.org website for, well, high 90s anyway, is to read the workbook lessons, right? So now instead of having to hunt for it, you literally will see today's workbook lesson by default. Later on, we may make that so that you can go to wherever you left off, which would even be cooler because then you could, on any browser or on any device, pick up where you left off for study groups or your own study. Anyway, there's a little ticker tape scrolling text that goes across the screen now on this prototype that we're working on. And I think it's going to be really cool because it'll, you know, get you right where you want to go to your workbook lesson, in addition to lots of other cool things that are added. So,
anyway, Very cool.
It's coming along nicely. So it's really actually in the next few days we'll probably pick up where we left off and get back on our launch schedule. So
very good.
Yeah,
and, I don't see Devin and Barb in the room yet, so I'll just ask you a couple just real quickly.
Sure.
And actually, I'm going to stop this recording.